This is Watch the Media. Happy Holidays. I'm John Schrader. Special treat for you in this holiday season. We'll share with you some of the work from our students here at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. You'll hear from Sam Knoll, Dylan Pelster, Thomas Cotto, and Lucas Garten this time around. Hope you enjoy it.
The Zone, thezone939.com. Hi again, everybody, and welcome from Hitchcock County, Trenton, Nebraska. Beautiful night for football here tonight. Sam Knoll alongside my dad, Sean Knoll, here tonight on a beautiful, perfect picture night for high school football. Thought we'd be dealing with a little bit of some cold weather, but as that sun is set, the breeze is coming up just a little bit, but a perfect 79 degrees, and Sean, what a beautiful night for football.
Yeah, when you think playoff football, you're thinking late October, you're thinking you're bundling up, you might be dealing with some sleet, possibly some flurry. No, it is absolutely gorgeous.
I think all boys and most men that have had the chance to grow up with a father figure in their life can honestly say they wouldn't change it for the world. With my dad, I would say it's been even better, and that he is truly my best friend. And I don't think that's most common with a lot of people. If you talk to my dad and then to me, you could say I'm the perfect cutout image of him, just with a little more hair on my face and scalp. I love talking to my dad about anything from sports to history to just life in general. While this does make people around us a little bored when we are talking about some podcast we both listen to, I wouldn't change it for the world. So for this class, when we had the chance to do a project about something personal, I instantly thought about my dad and how he does have some pretty cool stories about his days in broadcasting, even though they were short, but they were pretty eventful. My dad never really thought about growing up and becoming the next Vin Scully until he was able to start doing some games in high school. And well, I guess you could say the rest is history.
Thanks for you. Am I putting these on?
You can if you want
to. Oh, man. Yeah, this is all right.
I guess first one, how'd you get, what was like your first, I don't know, how'd you get your start in broadcasting?
How did I get my start? Actually, it was, I didn't really realize it at the time, but it was when I was in high school. I kind of piqued my interest a little bit. A couple of different ways. On the basketball end of things, I was the manager of the high school basketball team. And sophomore year, we got a new coach, Mr. Ublaker. And my roles kind of changed. And when game day rolled around, instead of me sitting on the bench handing out waters, he said, boy, we could really use someone to videotape the ball games. And so that sophomore year, I started videotaping. And then it was right towards the tail end of the year, I don't know why, just on some whim, I just started basically announcing with this camera on my shoulder. And, of course, this is the tape that the coaches watched, and then the players would eventually watch it, kind of as a learning tool. And they all kind of got a kick out of it. And that was back in the days when ESPN was still somewhat young. I mean, it was in its first decade of existence. And Chris Berman was probably the biggest celebrity on there. And so, you know, you kind of tried to act like him, and you gave everyone a nickname, and used a lot of his terms and what have you. And that got kind of a chuckle out of everybody. And so that just kind of continued junior year, senior year. I still did the same thing, and I started implementing more and more things. Introduced commercials into my little video broadcasts. These were just... These were just fake corporations, companies, businesses, what have you. But like the Jiffy Lube Mortuary was one of them that I can remember. That always got kind of a laugh out of everybody, and that was kind of my main goal, just kind of be light with everything. We kind of had promotions that we did, like Bald Head and Broads Night. So during timeouts, you just kind of zoom in on guys with bald heads or some of the nicer looking babes in the building. And then by senior year, we had found a kind of a desolate coat closet in the gymnasium area there, and we had a pregame show in there, and we'd break over there and halftime show and so forth, and I had usually a couple of the underclassmen helping me out, and yeah, it turned into quite a production.
So my dad was Strive before Strive was even a thought in anyone's minds. Well, I guess you could say maybe Strive's a little bit more professional. My grandma one time dug out some of those old tapes, and they were some of the best things that I had ever seen. It was so awesome to see my dad like that, and you could tell the passion he had for what he was doing. For my dad, I don't think it really ever occurred, even during that time, that somehow he could make a career out of just filming those basketball games for the local high school. And just like he talks about, it was really in college that it shifted from something to do to get the quick laugh to a career.
Really, truly get introduced to radio till I went to college, and that was at Colby Community College, and they had a radio station awfully similar to the one that you had at Northeast Community College. Actually, it spanned about 30 miles. I can't remember what the wattage was on it, but it would go the next small town over. Once again, as I was driving home, I could pick it up for about 30 miles. And it was a little bit different as far as college radio stations is concerned, in that they had a top 40 format. They weren't playing kind of odd alternative music. So, man, hey, this is all music I listen to all the time. So that was so cool. I went there with the idea of wanting to work in sports, but then really enjoyed the, you know, running a show and spinning music. At that time, we were still spinning a lot of records and some compact discs and using reel-to-reel machine and cart player and stuff.
My dad would land his first job in Salina, Kansas, and he would be there for a few years before getting laid off, something that is almost expected at least once or twice while working in broadcasting. After that, he was able to use his connections to get a job at McCook, and that is where he met my mom, and they were able to have me. My dad at that time realized that to become a millionaire, he was probably going to have to find another job. Fast forward about 18 years, and that is when I was able to have the chance to do some games for a high school class. And the next thing I knew, I was getting sucked in to become the next Vin Scully, just like my dad. And well, he was hoping that feeling would go away.
I was trying to do anything and everything to steer Sam away from doing this. And as I look at on it, back on it now, it's like I'm not quite sure why I was trying to. I guess honestly, it was those same reasons when I met your mother, and you know, this is a job that does take a lot of time. You know, when you're doing sports, especially, you're working a lot of evenings, a lot of Fridays, a lot of weekends, and that's time away from your spouse and your family. And so, I guess that's kind of one of the main things I had in mind, and I knew. Way back when you were in high school, you were a big history buff, and you and I like to talk a lot about history. We like to watch a lot of TV shows concerning history, a lot of documentaries and so forth. And it's like, man, Sam, you are a history buff. You would make a perfect history teacher. So that's what I was trying to steer you towards. But like a typical 16, 17, 18-year-old boy, you rebelled. And... you moved on to college, and you pursued the same line of work that I did at that time, and I'm not regretting it at all. No, honestly, I'm pretty proud of what you've done so far.
Well, my dad didn't steer me away, and instead, I have, you could say, I am now almost fully invested into broadcasting with a little help of dad's money as well, but that's a story for another time. During high school, and something that I have been able to do throughout college, is work for the local radio station in town. And for the past 2 years, I have been able to call McCook Bison football. There have been a couple of times where the main color guy that I have has been out of town, and I was in need of a color guy, and that is when I thought of no one better to do the game with me than my dad. And I was glad he was just willing to do it as well. It was truly a dream come true, and my dad thought the same thing.
Oh, I was thrilled. That was a true blast. Here in the time of smartphones, I was videotaping the two of us, sending it off to my parents so they could hear little bits and clips.
Six linemen out for the Hitchcock County Falcons, and then they have two men in the backfield along with the starting quarterback, Keenan Gaston. He is under center. Gaston takes the snap, fakes the handoff to the right. Now he's breaking off to the left. He's got some argument with the 40, 35, 30 to the 25 before he's finally down right about the 25-yard line, inside the 25. A great pickup of Keenan Gaston on first down and 10.
Good deception there by the Falcons. Gaston faked to the right, although all of his backs were going to the left. They loaded up that left side. He just followed them through. They set up some big blocks, and now they are in Maywood Hayes Center territory, and it's only the second play of the contest.
Me and my dad have now been able to do four games together, with all of them being football games, and each one has been some of the best times of my broadcasting career. My dad and I both share what our favorite moment doing a game together is, and it was this season when we did the first round playoff game between Hitchcock County and Maywood Hayes Center. The game was at least 70-0 by the fourth quarter and allowed my dad to tell some great stories.
And then, as far as that is concerned, the most recent game we did was actually the Hitchcock County playoff game against Maywood Hayes Center, which was a large blowout. And if I recall, by the fourth quarter, there was very little action talked about on the field, and we were just basically talking like, kind of like the old days when we'd sit in the basement and, you know, we'd be watching football, baseball, what have you, on the TV, and just talking sports.
Here's a high end-over-end kick that Maywood Hayes Center will let go into the back of the end zone. But a beautiful night for football. Started out 79 degrees tonight. Was a little hot. Sean, you had to shed a couple layers. But it's went all the way down to 58. And honestly, a perfect night for football. Just kind of has that fall feel in the air.
I think people actually kind of took offense when I took my undershirt off and was just going bare-chested. So I went ahead and...
You didn't put the
white shirt back on, but... Now we got the hoodie back on as we've probably dipped down under 60 degrees.
For Anders, sends Dibben in motion. Here's the snap, fakes it. Anders will run it up the middle of the football field. Picks up a couple of yards, possibly with forward progress, but coming in with the tackle is David Beasley. And
you don't suppose Seth and Jerry stopped by the local Trent watering hole? Hopefully Deb's not listening. She's probably expecting Jerry to be home by now.
I don't think so. I think Jerry wanted to get home, I'm sure. After a couple of tough games he's watched today, I'm sure he was wanting to get home. Seth, I'm sure, is compiling all his stats and getting ready to go for tomorrow.
He probably has a game tomorrow night, did he?
93.9 The Zone, 93.9.com. And if you're just joining us, it's been pretty simple tonight. One word, two words, actually. And they're making you remember his name. It's Colin Gaston. Seven touchdowns, 209 yards unofficially on the ground tonight. And it's 72-0.
I think I was just out back. They started erecting Colin's statue already.
72-0. Jack and Joe Buck. Marv and Kenny Albert, both of which are some famous announcing father-son duos, and maybe someday Sean and Sam Noel will be on that list. Well, even if not, it's still one heck of a story to say that you've called a game with your dad. There aren't words to describe how special it is, and I can't wait to do more games with him in the future.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome into Over Under 402. Wherever you may be and however you may be listening, this is Dylan Pelster coming to you from downtown Lincoln, Nebraska. Joining me today on the show will be Austin Dickey, a business management student at the University of Nebraska Lincoln, along with Cody Bennett, a journalism student at the University of Nebraska Lincoln as well. How's it going today, fellas?
I'm doing great.
I'm doing fantastic as well, Dylan. I'm eager to get started.
Yes. On today's episode of Over Under 402, we are going to be discussing the moment that we fell in love with sports. We have known each other for a number of years. We do a separate podcast together as well. We all are very passionate about sports in a different variety of fields. But when did we fall in love with sports, gentlemen?
that's going to be the main focus of today's conversation. How about I start off? I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster probably from the time I was in seventh grade, and maybe even a little bit before then. I always knew, growing up playing football, I just didn't have the makings of a varsity athlete, as they say in The Sopranos. I didn't, really. Now, granted, I did make the varsity team when I was in high school at Millard South playing football, but I knew I never really had talent to go to the college or to the professional level beyond that. But I had always loved sports more than anything else. It's my number one hobby, it's my first true love, and especially football was my first true love. But just sports in general, the moment I fell in love with sports was in a college football game back in 2013, folks. That would be the Iron Bowl between Alabama and Auburn that year. That was the Trey Mason-led Auburn team that had a miracle win against Georgia a couple weeks before. It was called the Prayer at Jordan-Hare. Well, 2 weeks later, they played Alabama in the Iron Bowl at Jordan-Hare Stadium in Auburn, Alabama. And it was probably the most infamous play in college football history. We know it as the Kick Six, but I will always remember where I was on that day. I was in my old house in my old neighborhood in Omaha, Nebraska, chilling in my basement with my father, just watching the game. It was a great game, and it was a game with massive implications. Keep in mind, that was actually the last year without the college football playoff. Auburn ended up playing Florida State in the national championship with Jameis Winston and company winning it, but the next year the college football playoff started. So this was the last year of the BCS format. It wasn't no two SEC teams getting in a college football playoff. It was, you gotta make the SEC championship to have a chance at a BCS national championship, right? Alabama and Auburn both being on the same side of the conference, both ranked in the top five. Whoever was going to win that game was going to have a chance to win the national championship. Whoever lost that game was going to have no chance to win the national championship. It was probably the most anticipated Iron Bowl game in probably over a decade between Alabama and Auburn, so there was massive implications in the game. Not only was the game great itself, AJ McCarron was great for Alabama, Auburn was great as well, but there was something that happened at the end of the game, and it's known as the Kick Six.
56-yarder. Does not have the leg. And Chris Davis takes it in the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45. There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game. He ran the missed field goal back. He ran it back 109 yards. They're not going to keep him off the field tonight. Holy cow. Oh, my God. Auburn wins.
That play will go down in college football history as the greatest play ever, and it really inspired me after. It's really what sports are about, too. The way the fans rushed the field after that game, right? The entire community is galvanized, right? That game on that particular Saturday, if you were in Auburn, Alabama, there was nothing else that mattered to you in your life for those 3.5 hours. There's something different about sports that really unites and galvanizes a community. Sports are always the fallback. We always talk about sports being involved with politics and how they sometimes intersect. The reality of the fact is they always intersect, but also the community aspect of sports always intersects as well. The fandom aspect of it was really just on full display right there. And that's what I love about sports the most, the way it can just galvanize and bring people together. And there was just something so holy about that moment where it really truly was the moment that I fell in love with sports. And it led me to want to be a broadcaster. I can remember a couple years after that game, the first four, Iowa versus Tennessee was playing a first four game in the NCAA tournament. I remember just being a little nerdy kid in my basement using a remote as a microphone to commentate a game between North Carolina State and Iowa. Maybe it was Tennessee-Iowa. Either way, it was a first four game, and it was just really, I loved calling games even when I was just using my remote as a kid. I knew when I got to high school, a lot of people aren't blessed. A lot of people go to college not knowing what they wanted to do when they grew up. I knew exactly what I wanted to be before I even had got to high school. Played football in high school. Injured my shoulder that sophomore season when I made it to varsity, played the entire year with 5 tears in my left shoulder, my left labrum to be precise. After that, I decided it was time to hang the cleats up. I already said a couple minutes ago, I knew I didn't have the makings of a varsity athlete beyond the high school level, but I knew that I could be a good broadcaster. I've always considered myself a very intelligent sports fan, a nerd, a fanatic, and I knew that this would be the right spot for me. So what did I do when I was a senior in high school? I started Millard South's media program. Cody, that is when we met each other when you were at Millard West. It's a story for another day, but the reality of the matter is that is what really kickstarted my love for sports, was the Kick Six. And really throughout the rest of middle school, I knew I wanted to be a sports broadcaster, and it really led me just on this path. And now I'm sitting here as a junior in college, just reminiscing on the past. And there's a lot of great sports moments I can think of. I can think of moments with my own fans or my own teams, being a fan of those teams. The Patriots, Super Bowl 49, Malcolm Butler, Super Bowl 51. Hell, even last March when Kansas won the national championship in college basketball. There's a lot of great moments that will stick with me forever. But I will always know where I was when the Kick Six happened. And that is certainly something I will tell my grandkids one day. Dickie, I now want to turn the conversation over to you. You have been, I guess, a friend of mine for a long time. We have both loved and grew up watching sports together. But what really is the time that you fell in love with sports and decided, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life?
Well, I had a few moments to choose from. I was thinking, you know, I always went to Nebraska games with my dad when I was younger. So those were some of my, like, first memories. But, you know, that I wasn't falling in love with sports then. I really liked baseball. I played baseball. Played some basketball, but I loved baseball. My favorite memory, what ignited my sports love, also came in the year 2013. Bases loaded, two outs. Joaquin Benoit is on pitching for the Detroit Tigers. 5-1 score, bottom of the eighth. October night, cold, chilly, David Ortiz at the plate. Wax one over the right field wall. Torrey Hunter goes piling over.
Bases loaded. Two out. Hard hit into right. Back at the wall. Tie game! Big Poppy! The grand slam!
Like, I remember sitting there with my dad. I'm sitting on the floor in front of the TV. He's sitting there behind me. He doesn't care. I'm just a young Red Sox fan. I was a little too young to remember 2004 and even 2007. I don't really remember at all. but that moment is like my first real Red Sox memory, where I like got up, screamed, rewind the TV like three times to watch it. It was, and that whole run was amazing. But yeah, it did not take long for me to like remember my past, where I was like, what is the sports memory? It was easy to choose. I remember that like right away. I had to circle through for like 2 seconds.
Especially considering baseball is your favorite sport. Now, the audience wouldn't know that just basically listening to us here tonight, but the Red Sox are your favorite team and baseball is your favorite sport. So being a young kid in 2013, when a play of that kind of iconic weight happens, just out of nowhere, 5-1 to 5-5, all of a sudden you have a chance, you're right back in the game. And then honestly, you go on to win the World Series. I mean, that's the kind of moment that really just sticks with you the rest of your life. And you think, why do I love sports? It's because of moments like this, when the crowd's going insane and David Ortiz is rounding the bases, just all fired up. And keep in mind, that was the same year as the Boston Marathon as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on in that city. We talk about how communities rally around their sports teams. It's a perfect example right there of a community rallying around the Red Sox. Boston Marathon bombing happened. Later that season, they win the World Series. It almost comes full circle. But honestly, Austin, the best part of that is honestly the picture of the police officer in the dugout.
Yeah, and he retired a few years ago. It was awesome. Like, he's just a cool guy. I've seen like so many clips of him like just walking around talking to the media and stuff. It's cool talking with the fans.
Yeah, and honestly, a lot of people really don't like Joe Buck as a broadcaster. Maybe he's not doesn't show enough enthusiasm from time to time. Really just is stale with his use of verbiage and that kind of stuff. That was one of his best calls he's ever made in his entire broadcasting career.
I think that's where like his kind of MO changed a little bit, because he, that World Series of the Rangers Cardinals, I mean, he was sick, of course, But after that moment, he's been like more enthusiastic. Before that moment, it was Mitchell.
And if you don't know that video, how about you just look up Joe Buck, Mitchell. But Cody, now we're going to direct the conversation to you, because honestly, I haven't known you as long as I've known Austin. When is the moment you fell in love with sports? And then I guess kind of talk about a little bit what you do at the College of Journalism here in Lincoln and what you want to do in the future with that passion for sports.
Of course, Dylan. Well, I just wanted to say first off, thanks for having me on the podcast tonight. Appreciate and honored to be a guest on here. Well, I am a junior at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I have a major in journalism and as well as a minor in communications and history. And to answer the latter first, way down the line, I'd like to end up somewhere, maybe ESPN, but something writing for sports, because you guys have showed me that, you know, watching sports all day is fun. Like, it's true. It's fun because every Sunday we do it. We do it at the house. We have 8 different TVs. We have all different kinds of reactions, fandoms, and all that stuff, all different inside jokes. And I feel like that's where the passion of sport kind of plays into, is because every person is different. Every person has different ideas, different sayings. Everybody has their own MO. But regardless, that's where my passion of sport stemmed from. But one moment that really ignited my sports love was, as you know, I'm a big Cubs fan. And before 2016, we did not win a World Series in the last 108 years.
It's a long time.
It is a very, very, very long time. And my dad has always been the biggest Chicago Cubs fan, and he raised me in a way where, you know, sports were a big part. I remember watching, he was a big Vikings fan as well. And I remember when Blair Walsh missed that field goal. And I remember 5 seconds later, a hole in our wall. And it's passion of sport, right? So, but regardless, the 2016 World Series run for the Chicago Cubs is probably my greatest memory of sport.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series! Bryant makes the play! It's over! And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
Because the implications behind it and the story. Because right now, I believe I can make a case that Game 7 of that 2016 World Series Cubs at Indians, Game 7, it did have 40 million people watching worldwide. I think that was the greatest or the most watched World Series game in the last, I think, 10 to 15 years.
Well, if it's the last 10 to 15 years, I honestly bet it's probably the most watched World Series game ever. And you talk about the story behind it, though, real quick, Cody. The 108 years is absolutely insane, but just the fandom experience, right? All those Cubs fans that have been through so much heartbreak, so much pain, so much agony, right? It comes full circle for them in 2016, right? It's those kind of stories that really just make sports matter, right? And sports do matter to a lot of us in a lot of different ways, like you were alluding to. And I think that run by the Cubs is just so special in so many ways, especially for those older Cubs fans, too, that are probably maybe 70, 75 years old. What they had gone through being a loyal Cubs fan for the majority of their lives, to finally see their team win it all after 70 to 75 years of being on this earth, it's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and to start it off, one of my couple favorite moments from that run has to be the NLDS against the Giants, where we played and it went to 4 games. And I remember game 1, 8th inning, 1 out, Javier Baez steps up to the plate. He's facing Johnny Cueto, and he does his little rock and he pitches it, and my goodness, when Javier Baez just slung the bat off his shoulder, and I forgot who announced that game, but he said it looked like it was going out to Waveland Avenue, and it did, but the wind was pushing in that day and it was on to just straight left field, and my goodness, it landed in the basket. And as we know, Matt Vasgersian, and it's in the basket. So that's one of my good memories from that one. But also game 7, I remember where I was, because I was behind the counter in my kitchen at the time at my mom's house. We were making churros for my Spanish project, or not project, just Spanish food day or whatever. I was making sure I was during game seven when it first started. Dexter Fowler walks up to the plate. He's the first player to hit a leadoff home run in World Series game seven history.
Pretty incredible. Just as fans, though, and it's pretty cool that those are the moments you fell in love with sports. Your fans finally win it all. But now I want to direct the conversation more to our future in sports, because those are the kind of moments that really shaped our past and have led us to the points that we are now. Why we have a driving passion for sports the way we do is because of these moments. Going forward, though, Cody, I already asked you a little bit, and you said you want to be involved in writing, too. I know you're also really good at production, too. Does that kind of stuff interest you as well?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, if I get offered a job to work for, you know, Colin Cowherd for The Herd, like for production at least, that would be fantastic, because you could learn a lot from these guys, right? You can make that your future as well. If you'd like, if you learn as much to market as well as you have the knowledge, bingo, right there. I feel like just any way to learn some experience in the real world, in a world that you love, in a way that, you know, you wake up every day not going to work, but you're going to do what you love. So, and that's not working a day in your life.
Dickie, how about you? What do you got planned for the future? And how did your love for sports, the moment you fell in love with sports, how has it really come full circle now, knowing what you want to do in the future?
Oh, well, just sports has really driven every, like, day of, I think, every one of our lives, like, every day of our lives. I mean, we probably watch a game a day at this rate. It's just come full circle, you know, sitting on the floor with my dad watching sports. And now I'm sitting with my friends watching sports all the time, every Sunday. And hopefully this management degree that I'm going to get will get me into a sports management position or somewhere involved in sports, because that's what I want to do. That's what I've wanted to do for the longest time. So,
and I can't agree with you more. This is what I have wanted to do for the longest time. There's something different about sports. Yes, we do watch sports essentially every day, ladies and gentlemen. But you know what? We love doing it, and we're going to keep doing it. There's no better feeling in the world than when your sports teams win it all, or when you just watch an insane game and everybody you're around is talking about it. Oh, like, I can't believe, did you just see this? What a play, this and that. There's so many aspects of sports that don't get talked about. There's so many aspects of sports that get hidden, like, in the moment. But when it all comes full circle, there really is nothing like sports in this society. And honestly, especially where we are as a country right now, sports bring us together more than anything else. And the perfect example of that would be, look at the U.S. men's national team. They only made it to the knockout stages in the round of 16, but look at how many people tuned in for that game against Iran. It's something. Just sports are special, man. Anything else you guys would like to add?
Like Cody said earlier, I appreciate you having me on for this. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, yeah, I've had a blast talking about my favorite sports moments and, you know, what makes me get out of bed in the morning, right? So and watch every Sunday.
Yes, and this is what gets me out of bed in the morning, too. I've wanted to be a broadcaster since I was in the 7th grade. It's coming into fruition now. We hope it continues. For Austin Dickey and Cody Bennett, this is Over Under 402 from Lincoln, Nebraska. Dylan Pelster signing off, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next time, and have a great rest of your evening.
Served by Melanie Para. This time it's in. Pass made. Jack back right side. Krause for the match.
She did it. They did it. Can you believe it?
Call the grandkids. Nebraska beats Texas. Nebraska takes down Texas. Your Huskers back where they belong. The Final Four. Go celebrate, Nebraska. Go celebrate.
Wild, historic, memorable. Those are three words to describe the journey John Baylor has been on. Since 1994, Baylor has been the voice of the Nebraska volleyball team on radio.
All right, well, I guess I just want to start by asking, John, how are you doing today? How you been?
I am okay. I got up really early. I had to teach this morning. And now I've pretty much got the rest of the afternoon off to prepare for tomorrow night's match and go play a little golf and enjoy myself. So I enjoy most of what I get to do, but it's particularly nice to kind of have a lot of work behind me. And I've had a pretty strong stretch of work of late.
While being the radio announcer for the Nebraska volleyball team is certainly a notable position, getting to this position was anything but simple for Baylor. Just looking at what you've been, your journey, like you lived in Nebraska, then you moved to Massachusetts, then you went to Stanford for college, then you tried to go to New York to work as a banker, then you went back to California because you were trying out to be an actor, where that's when you started becoming a broadcaster, eventually got you back here in Nebraska, and now fast forward to today, you're the broadcaster for the Nebraska volleyball team alongside working or being a part on the college. Just what is that whole journey like?
Well, it shows you that history depends on the observer, because someone observing the story you just described would say, I'm a chronic failure. And someone else might say, hold on, this has just been a staircase to this ultimate pedestal that is a very fun life. And it's not clear which is true. I mean, I tried a lot of things and it didn't work. I mean, one thing you didn't mention is I wanted to be a professional baseball player. And clearly that didn't work out. I wanted to be an actor. That didn't clearly work out. Bottom line is, Thomas, what it was a young man uncertain of what would allow him purpose. And I was searching for purpose. And that's a journey I hope everyone claims. I think there are a lot of folks in nursing homes that wonder what their purpose was and never ask the question, not to mention answer it. So I found in my purpose making a difference and having fun. And with teaching young people, preparing for the ACT, and calling volleyball games and doing some other broadcasting, I find both. So it's a fortunate ending, but a journey with some pain and self awareness that was accumulated at a price. So I urge everyone to pay that price so that when they are my age or hopefully much earlier, they have found their purpose.
Along with how crazy the path was for Baylor to get to these positions, his time in them also seemed to be quite the ride. As the radio voice for Nebraska volleyball, John Baylor has seen nothing but history from the Huskers, including 5 national championships, all of which he called. To just witness such history is already crazy enough, but for Baylor to call them is on another level.
You've been on crazy journey. You said
Odysseus had an easier journey than I did. My goodness, he made stops in Tunisia, the whole deal. But I've been here now almost 30 years.
And that's insane.
I'm not sure it meets the legal definition, but it is quite it was never expected. There was never a master plan. I never dreamed I'd move back to Lincoln, which is my childhood home. And here I am still for 30 years. It's a good life.
And to think back at Stanford, I mean, you called some baseball and basketball
True.
Games.
Not a lot.
But before that, imagine the first game you ever called. Could you have imagined at that point in time, you would say like you would have been calling a national volleyball school that has won 5 championships, is considered like the Alabama of volleyball, basically, where Alabama rules football, Nebraska rules volleyball.
You know, seriously, Thomas, it never crossed my mind that I'd make a career out of it, because I was raised to believe, you know, work was kind of a duty and you did something that was impressive and you know, somewhat lucrative and a means to freedom, effectively. But after trying banking, I thought to myself, hold on, I don't have to do what I'm supposed to do. I can forge this lesser known path, this less conventional path, and which ultimately will result in what I want to do. And nowadays, I think that's much more common, that mindset. I hope it is, because more people are choosing an entrepreneurial path, you know, start their own business, and more people are chasing the less conventional paths. And I think, you know, investment banking and banking itself and becoming a lawyer are less attractive and less common than they've been in the past. Being doctors is not what it used to be. Those were the pathways that I was growing up to assume you were intended to follow. Anyway, so it was a bit unusual, and my friends were making all this progress in all these conventional fields, and here I was flopping around making $1,200 a month doing local radio in my late 20s. And it was part of this journey to figure out, you know, what I love to do, and thankfully I found it.
Yeah, you definitely did. I can't imagine Nebraska fans who turn into the radio can't imagine them not being John Baylor, who's been here for pretty much
my 29th season.
Yeah, that's it's crazy just to think all this history kind of coming from just simply you wanting to come out here, call broadcasting. Like, if you hadn't decided to go call those broadcast games at Stanford, you probably wouldn't have been here.
That's probably right. If I hadn't spent a fair amount of time at KZSU doing an overnight 3-hour DJ show, which kind of got me the political clout to sit side by side with the play-by-play announcers on women's basketball, and then we never did any Stanford volleyball, and then some Stanford baseball games. That was it. I never got in the football booth in college. You gotta, you know, pay your dues, and I went abroad for my junior year, so I just never got the traction that was required. So, but by doing them, I had a feeling like I could do this and I enjoy this, but I'm not supposed to chase this. This is like an avocation. This is kind of a hobby. It's a fun extracurricular in college. But then when I was searching 4 years later after trying banking, I thought, well, hold everything. Why not chase that?
And you're a part of that. Like, for Nebraska volleyball, like I said, this, like, just the history behind this team, just everything that they've done. Like, you've been there. You've been at all 5 national championships when they won them. You called them. Just, what is it like to just be a part of that? Just, like, have that knowing, like, you have a ring. Like, you have a ring. That's insane. Like,
I got one more at home. It's an absolute honor, and it's frankly so unique that one person has had this box seat for all these years, because there's so much turnover in ownership. And then my life has changed so much. For all of it to work every year for 29 years is really unusual. But it allows me a perspective and understanding and an appreciation for a cultural phenomenon that if you're not from here, you don't fully appreciate it. And if you are from here, you just want to be close to it. And I've been given this opportunity, and I'm very, very grateful for it.
Considering how all this began because Baylor didn't make the college baseball team shows that anything is possible for college students. However, Baylor had his own piece of advice for those in the college world.
I got one more question. What's a piece of advice that you think college students should have?
Be intentional. Don't take this for granted. Have fun, but have a plan. You can do both. They're not mutually exclusive. And, you know, really search and try to decide what gets me jazzed. What is all consuming for me? What causes me organically to just commit, wants to be all in? And that's a magical moment when you find it, because it's fully immersive. See, most of us go around partially distracted, right? And that compromises our performance and creates this gap between our performance and our potential. If you're all in, that gap is small. It may be even non-existent. So to find what it is that causes you to forget about those distractions that afflict you the rest of the day and instead fully focus, that's magic. Search for that. Don't give up that journey. Don't give up that goal, because boy, when you find it, it's worthwhile. And if what that is also can allow you to make a living and you're also good at it, oh my goodness, that's the perfect intersection, right? It'll allow me to make a living. I'm all in, I'm fully committed, and I'm pretty good at it. Wow. Stay on that path and someday you'll be great at it.
For KRNU Sports, I'm Thomas Cotto.
Welcome to World Cup Stories. I'm your host, Lucas Garden. Today's episode dives into the United States national team and how they fared at the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. To know this iteration of the U.S. national team, you have to understand how big a failure it was for the team not to qualify for the previous World Cup in Russia in 2018. All they needed was a draw against Trinidad and Tobago, a team that had nothing to play for, to make sure that they would make it to the World Cup. The U.S. lost, however, 2-1. For a team that was supposed to be the next big thing, missing out on the World Cup was huge. It was an egg on the face of all those that supported the team. After the game, former U.S. national team player and now ESPN pundit Taylor Twellman ripped the team, yelling at the top of his lungs, "What are we doing?" over and over again.
Are you kidding me? We can't beat Trinidad on a field that's too wet and too heavy? What are we doing? What are we doing? This is the discussion that's being had.
It has now been 8 years since the United States has participated in a World Cup, and 5 since the loss in Trinidad. The stars of yesteryear are long gone. The goal by Landon Donovan, a U.S. Soccer Hall of Famer, against Algeria in 2010 to put the U.S. through to the knockout round of the World Cup in South Africa is over a decade old and barely a memory for most fans of the team. If you were to compare the last U.S. team that was in the World Cup in 2014 to this current iteration that manager Greg Berhalter has put together for the 22 World Cup in Qatar, there'd be only one name that would be on both rosters. DeAndre Yedlin, who at just 29 years old is one of the most experienced players on the roster, with stops in big Premier League clubs before his most recent move back to the U.S. to play for Inter Miami in MLS. Greg Berhalter, the current U.S. national team manager, comes into the World Cup managing the team since 2018. He played for the U.S. national team for 10 years while playing club soccer with multiple clubs such as the LA Galaxy and Crystal Palace. After he retired in 2011, he was an assistant with the LA Galaxy before getting a manager position in the second tier of Swedish soccer, before returning to the United States, where he also managed the Columbus Crew from 2013 to 2018, where he got to MLS Cup before being beaten by the Portland Timbers. As a national team manager, Berhalter has had his ups and downs. In the summer of 2021, the United States beat their fiercest rivals, Mexico, not once, but twice for silverware, once in the Gold Cup and once in the Nation League's final. But in 2022, the U.S. had struggled to play well in their warm-up matches for the World Cup, with an embarrassing loss to Japan, 3-0, and a dull 0-0 draw against Saudi Arabia, a team that the U.S. supporters say that U.S. should play off the pitch most times. Berhalter has also drawn much criticism for not bringing Ricardo Pepi, a striker that many felt was the best in the U.S. player pool, to the World Cup. He's also drawn criticism for being married to a system that doesn't seem to best suit the U.S. players. The USA are in a competitive group with top 10 team in the world England, Wales, and Iran. It really is a 50-50 chance if the U.S. can get enough points in the group stage to get out of the group. But the job security of Greg Berhalter rides mainly on how well he does in this World Cup. The U.S.'s first game is against Wales, and it takes place at the Ahmed bin Ali Stadium. Wales, on paper, seems old, but the team has been playing with each other for a long time now. They qualified for the first time since 1958 for this World Cup. They're led by Gareth Bale, who is well past his prime at age 33, and some suspect is playing his last international tournament for Wales. The match kicks off. The U.S. strike first with a ball that is played perfectly between two Welsh defenders by U.S. star Christian Pulisic to Timothy Weah, son of soccer legend George Weah. Timothy Weah receives the pass in stride with the outside of his right foot, puts the ball into the back of the net to give the U.S. a 1-0 lead in the 39th minute. The U.S. go into halftime looking good with a majority of chances and what seems to be all the momentum. At the beginning of the second half, Welsh manager Robert Page makes a crucial substitution, taking out youngster Daniel James for the veteran Kiefer Moore. And with that substitution, it seems that all the U.S. chances dry up for the most part. Later in the second half, Greg Berhalter makes substitutions to become more defensive and hold on to the lead. But all that seems to happen is more chances for Wales to score. Then it happened. normally always dependable center back, Walker Zimmerman, makes a mistake and fouls Gareth Bale in the box while trying to go for the ball. It was a clear and obvious penalty. Zimmerman had gone right through the back of Bale, sending Bale falling to the ground in agony. The referee blows his whistle and points straight to the spot for a penalty. And with all the poise in the world, the Welsh captain Bale steps up to take the penalty, easily slotting it away past a diving Matt Turner in the top right corner of the goal. 10 minutes later, the full-time whistle blows. The match ends in a 1-1 draw. Up next in just 4 days for the U.S. is England, who had easily dispatched Iran earlier in the day with 6 goals. On match day 2 of the tournament, the United States lined up against England with the same starting lineup as the game against Wales, but with Haji Wright at striker instead of Josh Sargent. England had become perennial powerhouses in the last couple of international tournaments. In 2018, they fell just short of the final before losing it in the semifinals to runner-up Croatia in the World Cup. And in 2020, were the runner-up in the Euros, losing to Italy on penalties. England brought a team to the 22 World Cup full of stars like Harry Kane and Jude Bellingham. Any one of the England national team players would easily walk into the U.S. national team and be the best player. To say the least, the U.S. had their work cut out for them. As the match kicked off, the U.S. seemed the better side, creating chances but not being able to finish them off. England came on strong in the second half, but goalie Matt Turner put on a man-of-the-match performance in net for the United States and keeps England from scoring. The full-time whistle blew and it finished 0-0, giving the U.S. 2 points overall. The match was one of the biggest in U.S. men's national team history, being the most watched in the U.S. ever. Also, with the 0-0 draw, England is yet to beat the U.S. in a World Cup. Iran earlier beat Wales, jumping the U.S. into second and leaving them in third, setting up for a big match day to end the group stage. The third and final match day of the group was huge. The U.S. needed to beat Iran, a team that seemed to come together after their first game of the tournament where they lost 6-2. The United States had been in this position before, way back in 2018, when all they needed to do was to win against Trinidad and Tobago to advance to the World Cup. The two games are eerily similar in that the U.S. needed to win both to advance, and the U.S. was also heavy favorites to do so. But just because you're supposed to win doesn't mean that you do win, as the U.S. saw in 2018. Also, Iran had kicked the U.S. out in the 1998 World Cup, an embarrassment that the U.S. and its fans had not forgotten. Iran came into the game very defensively, trying not to give up a goal. Then, in the 38th minute, a ball over the top from Weston McKennie finds right back Sergiño Dest, who crosses it into the back post where a running Christian Pulisic taps the ball over the line, giving the U.S. a 1-0 lead and a potential spot in the round of 16. Iran turns into an attacking team, putting on goal scorers to try to score, but fails to do so. The game finishes 1-0, sending the U.S. through to the round of 16 against the Netherlands. The round of 16 is where the U.S. has struggled in the past World Cups. In all the World Cups the U.S. has qualified for, which is 10, they have only made it past the round of 16 twice. The last time being in 2002, and before that, it was in 1930 in the first ever World Cup. The Netherlands won the group to play the United States. They, like the United States, had failed to qualify for the last World Cup, and we're looking to bounce back. they also had, for the most part, a young squad, much like the United States. The U.S. had proven in the group stage that on their best day, they could play with anyone in the tournament. Going into the game, hopes were high for the U.S. to go through to the quarterfinals. The match whistle blew to start the game. Then bam. Not 10 minutes into the match, the U.S. had turned over the ball and the Netherlands scored on the counterattack, with Memphis Depay putting the ball away into the back of the net. And then again. Right before halftime, the Netherlands scored again with an almost identical goal. The U.S. had been caught with the tiniest mistake again, and the Dutch had made them pay again. Haji Wright's goal in the second half was all the momentum that the U.S. was able to gather before the Dutch put a knife in the heart of all U.S. supporters, scoring again, this time Denzel Dumfries, who had assisted on the first two goals, finishing the chance off. When the final whistle blew, it was 3-1 to the Netherlands. The U.S. had been knocked out of the World Cup again in the round of 16. The U.S. and Greg Berhalter had been outplayed and outmanaged by the Netherlands for most of the match. In response to the game, Berhalter had to say this about the performance in the World Cup to ESPN.
Clinical finishing. I think we played a good game. We put a tremendous amount of effort into the game. At the end of the day, we walked into halftime 2-0 down. It was like, what just happened? Because we played a really good half and the guys gave everything. So, you know, that's soccer sometimes, but, you know, the team really came together this tournament and I think showed the U.S. and the rest of the world that it's a team they can be proud of.
Looked like you had a nice moment with a couple of players on the field afterwards. Yeah. I saw you with your arm around Christian. Yeah. What'd you say to him? What was the message?
You know, it's sad. It really is. You know, it's an end of a group being together. You know, we talked last night about, you know, this team will never be together again, right? This exact group of individuals will never be together again. And they really formed a tight bond. So it was a sad ending. You never want to lose like that. And it was just really taking a moment to recognize them and thank them for all their efforts.
We talked last week about how it's tough. International soccer managers are judged on a really small number of games. When you look at this World Cup, how do you evaluate your own performance?
You know, I don't think it's time for me to evaluate my own performance. What I would say is that, you know, a measuring stick is, you know, can Americans watch what they saw and be proud of it? Can they be proud of the team? And, you know, a lot of the answers come back yes in that regard. So, you know, I'm proud of this group. I'm proud of how they stuck together and what they showed the outside world.
For many, the 22 World Cup will be a success, something for the U.S. to build off of, going into a 2026 World Cup that will be hosted in the United States as well as Mexico and Canada. But was it a good enough performance to keep Greg Berhalter? He did, after all, only win one game, but he also only lost 1-2, though. Some believe that it wasn't, and that you shouldn't keep a manager for longer than the one World Cup cycle. If so, who does the U.S. turn to lead it into a World Cup that they will have heavy expectations on? Joachim Löw, Jesse Marsh, or even Herve Renard? Berhalter, in the coming days, will have a big decision to make if he wants to try to continue with the U.S. or return to club football. The U.S. men's national team had some key takeaways from the World Cup. They, for one, can play with anyone in the world on their day. But they also lack a striker, something that many other countries have struggled with as well in this World Cup. Looking forward, all eyes will be on how they perform in the 2026 World Cup that will be hosted in the United States. A tournament that the now young U.S. squad will have all of its players in their primes and ready to go. If this World Cup told the U.S. one thing, it is that they are just one or two key players away from making a real run for the final. I'm your host, Lucas Garten, and this has been World Cup Stories.
Thanks so much to Lucas Garten, Thomas Cotto, Dylan Pelster, and Sam Knoll for sharing some of their work with us this time around on Watch the Media. We come your way from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications and the studios of 90.3 FM KRNU. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media.